elation. The cream-colored sheets beneath her fingers possessed a faint luster, their surfaces smooth, their edges trimmed with delicate gold embroidery. When she ran her hands across them, they felt like cool water to the touch, as if they had been woven from pure spider silk. Above her hung a thick canopy of golden damask, pinned in its center by an emblem entwined with intricate filigree. Tied around each of the bed's four mahogany posts were drapes of wine-red velvet. Celine threw back the bed covers and sank her bare toes into the luxurious Aubusson carpet, the tassels along its edge glinting in the candlelight. Countless paintings hung on the far side of the bedchamber, extending the full height of the room, some 20-odd feet. A few were the width of Celine's palm. Others stood more than double her height. Each was rendered by the hand of a master, the details within both dark and light, as if their collector appreciated the contrast of sunlight and shadow in equal measure. Crowning the remaining three sides of the room was a kind of narrow balcony, the likes of which Celine had never seen before. Shelves upon shelves of books filled the walls along the upper half of the chamber, oiled casters and iron ladders awaiting their savant's inevitable return. Tall scented candles had been lit around the room, as if Odette had known how disconcerting it would be for Celine to wake in a cold and unfamiliar place. She crossed the chamber toward a pair of mullioned windows, numbness tingling along her extremities. She'd slept hard. Surprisingly so, given the shocking tenor of recent events. When Celine tugged aside the heavy curtains to look outside, she discovered two things of note. That there were, indeed, wrought iron bars encasing every window, painted a glossy white, and that nightfall still reigned supreme on the world below. Despite Odette's final admonition for Celine to sleep until the sun rose, she'd woken in that time just before dawn, when night was at its darkest. Celine studied the scene beyond her barred window, noted the lack of a balcony outside. The level of security for the top floor of the domain was certainly extreme, as if it were intended for a visiting dignitary or a member of royalty. Celine retraced her steps, taking stock of every entrance and egress. The main access to the room was a set of double doors, built to look as if they were part of the intricate paneling, their edges trimmed in gilt leaf molding. Another door leading to a washroom appeared as if it were a piece of art in its own right, a thick frame concealing its seams. Inside the washroom, a large tub of hammered copper stood on a raised platform, surrounded by squares of white marble tile. Every sconce in sight had been encrusted with crystals. The air around Celine smelled of irises and sweet water, the flames of countless white candles dancing along the walls and ledges. Her feet steady on the cold marble, Celine shucked her still damp dress, not even bothering to collect it from the floor. In rote silence, she removed the hairpins from her scalp, pausing to rub the sore spots they'd left behind. Then she moved toward a porcelain bowl and pitcher, enclosed by a three-sided mirror of embellished brass. She stared at her reflection, at eyes wider than raccoons and hair like a murder of crows. Dried blood still dotted her skin. The red specks were especially disturbing beside her eyes, which glittered with a consumptive light, as if Celine were possessed of a fever. Without a second thought, she filled the basin with clear water from the pitcher and began splashing her face, scrubbing at her cheeks until they looked raw. Until all three versions of herself reflected in the mirrors appeared appropriately chafed. Celine didn't pause to dry her face. She returned to the canopied bed and drew the covers to her chin, letting the wetness soak through the sheets, cooling her heated skin. Her gaze settled above the large fireplace parallel to the foot of the four-poster bed. It had been cut from a solid block of Italian marble, the screen before it fashioned of meshed iron and gold. Hanging above the tiered ledge was a portrait of a young man of no more than 25, a devilish whorl of black hair falling across his forehead, and the knowing glint of a pirate in his eyes. Though his coloring was much fairer than Bastion's, and his face possessed a distinctly European bent, Celine could detect a vague resemblance, most especially in the cut of his jaw, in the unmistakable arrogance of his amber gaze. A gold skeleton key rested in his palm, a crimson ribbon dangling from a loop at its end. A young man of obvious means, who possessed the key to countless doors. How droll. But the most striking thing about the portrait was its palette. The subject's skin and features had all been rendered in believable tones, but everything else stretched the notion. The shadows were too bright a blue, the edges a blur. The corners splashed with ochre paint as if the artist had been on the cusp of madness. Celine stared at the painting for a time, then closed her eyes. She felt as if she were being watched, as if the portrait's gaze followed her, like the stories of the Leonardo da Vinci masterpiece, the Mona Lisa. She decided to focus on the taper beside her head, which dripped wax down its brass holder in steady streams, until the gleaming candelabra appeared as if it were weeping. Another disconcerting sight. Everywhere Celine looked, something sinister sprang to life. She thought about waiting until the sun rose to return to sleep, until the rays of white gold light seeped into her silken sheets. The sight of dawn should bring with it a measure of peace. Why did Celine not feel as if it would? Her head sank into the sumptuous pillow, her body restless, the eyes at the foot of her bed, taunting. Disturbed by the sense of being watched while she slept, Celine drew the wine-red curtains around the bed and swallowed herself in the comfort of darkness. Hiver, 1872. Rue Bienville, New Orleans, Louisiana. From my deserted street corner, I watch the expensive curtains on the uppermost floor of the Hotel du Maine shift to one side. The face of a stunning young woman with sharp green eyes and hair the color of spilled ink pierce through the opening, only to vanish in the next breath, the heavy damask falling back into place. I smile. Fitting that they would take her to Nicodemus's rooms, a chamber suited for a sun king, replete with a garish display of wealth, the kind to which she has grown accustomed over the years, an homage to Versailles at its best, or at its worst, depending on one's perspective. No matter. Nicodemus is rarely there now. He knows better than to come to New Orleans and tempt his fate. He has lost much in the last few years. But I have lost more, and there is still much for us both to lose. Memories and hopes, wishes for a future that can never be replaced once it is gone. By now, Nicodemus has undoubtedly been summoned from the safety of his New York lair in response to the rash of recent murders in New Orleans. He will return to the city soon, just as I have foreseen, precisely in time for my final performance. Satisfaction winds through my limbs,
causing me to drop my guard for a moment. All is unfolding according to plan. I relish this twinkle of time before I allow the rage to collect in my chest and color my vision. Then I breathe deeply of the briny air. Let the dampness fill my lungs as my heightened senses stretch, soaking in every detail in my vicinity. A horse nearby with an aching tooth, smelling of blood and sweet decay. Crumbs of rye bread swirling about in the gutter, their perfume sour and pungent. A dead rat lingering in the corner of a nearby sewer, the maggots on it wriggling beneath the beam of moonlight. And just around the bend, the beating of hearts, one old, two young. If I had to guess, the younger ones are engaged in an act of lust, their hearts racing in tandem with their sighs. The old heart thuds slowly, steadily, beating toward its inexorable end. Another creature of the night draws close. My muscles tense and my teeth lengthen on instinct like the claws of a cat. I reassure myself when I realize it is a familiar scent, when I need not fear. I continue breathing deeply until my shoulders fall. Then I look once more to the top floor of the domain. Another haunt I know well, down to its secret doors and hidden passageways. Not long ago, I visited these rooms under cover of night, taking in the world of my enemies, knowing I would face them all soon. I even chose to lie upon Nicodemus's bed and admire his collection of books, the shelves of which crown the towering space like a glittering tiara. I pushed the ladders along their oiled casters and marveled at the gleaming motions before pocketing one of my favorite tomes, a first edition of The Count of Monte Cristo. Pity, I missed the chance to bid my beloved Alexandra final farewell. Contentment ripples across my skin at the wash of memories. Nicodemus's bedchamber is a fitting place to leave my next mark. I linger in my delicious reverie along my street corner, a pleasant hum forming behind my lips. A song from a brighter, happier time. A beggar passes by, her hands outstretched for an alms, her shawl a tattered rag flapping in the breeze. Her heart thumps in a recognizable pattern, the old soul I sensed moments ago. I reach into my pocket to offer her everything I possess, a small fortune by anyone's standards. I have no need of money. What I need, I take. Currency is not important to a creature like me. I do not seek to rest beneath the golden canopy or bathe in a room full of polished marble. I seek only to survive. No, That is a lie.
I wish to thrive.
To see those who would bring an end to my existence die
a slow, agonizing death.
After they witness everything they value crumble to pieces before them. It is only fitting.
Bless you, the beggar woman says. A sibilant sound whistling from between her handful of teeth.
May the Lord keep you, I reply with a smile. My voice catches her off guard. I am unsurprised by this. Its rich music lulls mortals closer in a way that never ceases to amuse me.
It helps greatly in salving the path toward their inevitable demise.
In a way, I would argue we are among the most perfect of predators.
We mime the mannerisms of our prey.
We walk among them, unknown and unseen. By the time they realize they are caught in our web, it is far too late. The transformation is the click of a tumbler,
the turn of a handle,
the end of a life.
Here one moment, gone the next. There is only one other kind of creature that rivals us in such a way. Or perhaps two, though I find most woodland folk genuinely annoying, with all their talk of glamour and promises, with their gleeful tales of tricking mortals into making disastrous bargains. Why would I have need of anyone's firstborn child? A mewling infant is a nuisance, not a reward. And only true monsters would make meals of such a thing. Besides that, I do not bargain with lesser beings. I take. After which I make the necessary amends so that I might one day thrive. It is a blessing to even hope for such a future, given the stains of our past.
I remember the last time I watched a vampire die. She was a vampire I loved beyond words, though I knew I should not.
For I realized it would amount to nothing but heartbreak.
But when
one finds a kindred spirit, how is it possible to turn away? These connections are so rare, even for immortals. For me, they are the food of life. I watched as they threw Marin into a narrow pit. Those in my coterie bore witness from the sidelines as cloaked sentries. I buried my affection for her deep behind my heart, locked it tightly in my chest, so that none of our ranks would know how much I loved a creature who flouted our rules and treated the gifts given to her as nothing more than tokens of appreciation from a dark god. It was one of the things I appreciated most about her. Marin never took herself too seriously, after they threw her in the pit. It took a moment for her to regain her bearings. Only a moment. She realized where she was the instant she looked up. I remember seeing her face as the knowledge passed through her. Thankful she could not discern me from the shadows. She was terrified. Her eyes turned to stone, leached of all light. But she laughed, defiant to the end. She called out to us, knowing we stood on the fringes under cover of darkness, safe in our self-righteousness, secure in the cloak of our shared hatred. Marin hurled terrible names in our direction, demanded to know what we sought to prove by putting an end to our existence. I call it an existence because, to this day, I do not believe what she lived was a life. Hunting under cover of night, in constant war with the beasts of the other world.
In constant worry about whom to call friend and whom to call foe. It was not a life because Marin never longed for anything more. She was complacent. She learned nothing in all her years. And in the end, this complacency failed her. She should have betrayed me before I betrayed her. She never should have been my friend. I never should have loved her. It brought
me nothing but pain in the end.
The reminder of her
skin, soft and hard all at once, like
velvet and steel.
The taste of
her lips upon mine, ever
so bittersweet.
But no matter. That is a story for a different night. Not long after Marin was thrown into the pit, the sun began to shift over the opening of the narrow chasm, slipping in place of the waning moonlight. We all watched in silence while its rays streamed toward the stone floor. We listened as Marin laughed louder,
pressing her body against the stacked stones of the cylindrical chamber.
She cried for help in the last moments, screamed through her laughter, begging for a reprieve,
howling for rescue, her song a broken melody. Her shrieks haunted me for years. The smell of her flesh as it burned is a memory that still turns my stomach, and not much can do that anymore. Alas, fire will never be my friend.
In the years that followed, I hardened myself to such sights.
These punishments were necessary if my kind intended to survive. If we meant to establish our place in this world.
After Marin's death, her coven scattered to the far corners of the earth. Every so often I would hear tales of one of its ranks stalking one of ours in retaliation. A fool's errand.
True vengeance does not happen in a moment. It happens over time. The careful doling out of chips, the assiduous display of self-control. When I reap what I have sown, it will be in safety. It will be a breath to savor, and I will be far away when it finally comes. I turn from my lovely street corner, moving toward a narrow alleyway shrouded in a thick darkness. Place in which my kind have thrived for centuries, across all the continents of the world. I sense a familiar presence, though it moves without sound. I wait until it draws near, close enough that I am the only one to hear his words. Master, he says, his eyes glowing like embers in the night. I did as you asked. I nod, my features cool, aloof. Even through the layers of darkness, it is impossible to miss the adoration in his gaze. The almost feverish desire to garner my approval. And the girl, I continue, she is no longer welcome at the convent. He practically vibrates with the pleasure of delivering this news. Irritating, how much she craves my affection. Like a dog begging for its master's touch. Good, I say. And the court. Amusement tinges his words. They know of her plight. A member of their thieving ranks was sent to her rescue. Delicious. It will make my vengeance that much sweeter.
Does he know?
My faithful servant draws closer, the scruff on his youthful chin shadowing his inhuman speed.
I assume as much. The Valmont creature will undoubtedly tell him. She angers me, master. I wish to silence her now, more than ever.
I wish to silence them all for what they stole from us.
The girl is incidental, as are the rest. The usurper alone matters.
Silence. Swallows us for a breath.
Master, he says,
his voice tentative. What is the meaning behind the Carthaginian symbols you've instructed me to leave?
It is the mark of my kind. Its deeper meaning need not concern you. I keep my tone flat, my rejoinder final.
When my servant shifts back in frustration,
his motions send a whiff of dried blood in my direction. Immortal blood. I narrow my gaze at him. What caused you injury?
She attacked me, master.
I smirk at him. You allowed a witless human girl to get the better of you?
I did not expect her to be so fearless.
I told you already she has met death and lived to tell the tale. Of course she would be capable of causing you harm. You are lucky the blade was not made of silver. Yes, master, he grumbles. Is there anything else you need of me? I sense his irritation. He did not wish for me to learn of his wound. He even endeavored to conceal it by changing his shirt. More than his need for revenge, this one's pride will be his undoing. His desire to be noticed, to be deemed the savior who resurrected his fellow demons of the night, those of us banished from the Sylvan Wild, back to their rightful place among the wintry stars. But Lazarus was no savior, and this pathetic Quim is no concern of mine. They are all expendable, each a means to my end. Master, he presses, is there any other service you require? Not at this time. I pause. No, that isn't true. I wish for you to take a bath, master. His puzzlement vexes me. You may have changed your garments, but still you reek of death. They will smell it on you before they set eyes on you. I resort to my greatest asset, the power to hold lesser beings in my thrall with nothing more than my words. This is your next lesson. If you wish to command respect and rise above your ranks, you must be better than your brethren. Far more cunning. Your life was stolen from you, and you have been relegated to a place of servitude far too long. But you are not a servant. You have at hand the tools to be king of this jungle, a means to bridge the divide and save us all. I let my voice fade with significance, my features high in their regard. A lion, he breathes, his eyes luminous in their glory. I nod. But you must never forget all the world's stage, and all the men and women merely players. He finishes with a flourish. I direct him to leave with a jerk off my chin. He bows before dissolving into the darkness. He steps light with his success. Insignificant fool. He is eager to please me. Eager to assume the usurper's role and settle into a position of power. It is why I singled him out not long ago. For I am also eager to take from my enemy what has been taken from me. To have him know what it feels like to have a love lost and a trust broken. Briefly, I recall the moment the betrayal tore through my soul. The realization hollowed me, the way a scorching of one's essence is wont to do. It took years for me to collect the embers, to remake of myself something whole. After that, trying time, I no longer felt sorrow for what I had lost. I only felt anger, hatred. Now I feel vengeance. It tastes sweet. Sweeter than all the blood and death I could ever hope to swallow. One man in his time plays many parts. They thought there was no reason to fear me, that I had scattered to the winds like ashes from an urn. They sought to steal my birthright and install a false king upon the throne. They were wrong.
A Midsummer Night's Soiree.
No. B.
Bastien had refused to meet with Celine. The insufferable cad hadn't even bothered to display the barest measure of civility in his response. The first 5 times she read his note, his initial scrawled larger than life along the bottom of the page, rage had coursed through her veins. She'd resorted to pacing across the plush carpet of her borrowed bedchambers, seething with fury. Then, on the 6th reading, she'd composed herself, settled her expression. Rage was a moment. He would regret this forever. Coolly and calmly, Celine made plans. She sent a note to Odette via the hotel's courier, who passed along Odette's immediate reply, informing her of Bastien's plans for the evening. He would be attending the Midsummer Night's Soiree hosted by a member of the 12th Night Revelers. The same party Celine had declined to attend when Odette had invited her at dinner only a few days ago. That particular evening, it had not served a purpose. But today was a different story. Celine intended for this event to serve several purposes, all in her favor. Indeed, she would frequent every ridiculous carnival function in the foreseeable future, even the blasted masquerade ball itself, if it meant rooting out the perpetrator of these ghastly crimes, which were now occurring around her once a week. Her plan tonight was twofold: to gain answers to her many questions from the lion himself, and to inform the killer that Celine Rousseau was not going to tuck tail and run, but she planned to stay and fight. She took time to make herself ready. It didn't matter that she had less than a single afternoon to procure a costume. Another quick message to Odette secured Celine a dress borrowed from a family who owed the court a barrel full of money. The resulting gown did not fit Celine well, but she spent the latter part of the day remaking it to suit the occasion, an outdoor event held alongside a manse in the wealthiest lane of the garden district. To be sure, it was in poor taste for Celine to be attending a party of any kind, mere days after she'd been cast out of the convent. But it didn't matter anymore. Proper society didn't hold a place for Celine anyway. It was high time she removed herself from its confines. After she finished applying the final details of her costume, Celine placed Bastien's letter into the pocket of her borrowed gown. She planned to reach inside every so often to pinch the piece of parchment between her fingers, imagining it was his neck. The idea alone steeled her spine. He might have avoided her earlier summons, but Sébastien Saint-Germain would not be able to elude Celine tonight. Tonight, she would have her answers. She would know the truth about the yellow ribbon, about his involvement in these murders, what exactly all the members of Le Coeur de Lion were. Finally, she would know where they all stood. If they weren't fighting with her, they were against her. And Celine intended to use every tool in her arsenal to protect those she cared about, and herself, from whatever may come. Even if hell itself unleashed all its monsters on the Crescent City. Rapturous screams ran along the hedge of ochre rose bushes at Celine's back. A man streaked past the entrance to the garden maze, his garments covered in leaves, twigs placed strategically throughout his hair, champagne dribbling from his fluted glass. He laughed, glancing over his left shoulder while he ran. A young woman in diaphanous skirts dyed the color of palest jade almost rammed into Celine in her efforts to trail after the drunken gentleman. The girl raced into the boy's arms, and they crashed into each other before dissolving in a fit of laughter. Celine inhaled slowly. It might have been a mistake for her to come here. The longer she wore this gown, the more she realized how ill it suited her. Its basque of emerald silk polonaise was hot, its layers of cream-colored underskirt heavy. Worse still, its smaller size had forced her to tight-lace into her stays, and, as evinced by the other costumes guests had chosen for a soiree themed after Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, all her efforts had clearly been for naught. The members of New Orleans' upper echelons had taken the party's theme as nothing more than a light suggestion. Already, Celine had caught sight of people dressed as forest nymphs or fairy sprites, replete with paste gems, translucent garments, and twigs affixed to their elegant frock coats. At least 5 satyrs were in attendance. 5 young men from prominent families dressed as randy goats. 1 was already too many, in Celine's opinion. Had they even seen or bothered to read the play? Celine had hoped to channel Hermia, a character named after the god of trade. As such, it felt fitting to don a dress the color of greed. Along her cheekbones and around her eyes, she'd stippled flakes of paper-thin gold leaf into the shape of coins, positioning them as if they were falling from the crown of ebony curls at the top of her head. Actual bills had been pinned to her coif, half of which she had left down, thrown carelessly over one shoulder. It had been years since society had deemed it appropriate for Celine to wear her hair unbound in public. Hang society, anyway. Well, hang it halfway, at least. At Odette's insistence, a final touch of powder made from crushed pearls had been dusted across Celine's face and décolleté. "You simply must, my dear," Odette had said, as if this made a sliver of sense. Every time Celine bent one way or leaned to reach for something, she could hear the seams of the emerald basque start to scream. She'd laced her stays as tightly as they would go, and still the rich green fabric across her bust was holding together on little but a prayer. By the end of the night, her breasts were likely to burst free from her corset, a sight that would draw a certain kind of ignominy. Though it would advance Celine's removal from proper society, it might bring about this conclusion in an abrupt manner. One with which she was not yet entirely comfortable. But, from the way the evening looked to be progressing, it might not be the most scandalous event of the night. The moment Celine and Odette had entered the glittering foyer of this magnificent home, champagne had been poured liberally to any and all who wished to partake. Hours later, the glitziest pillars of New Orleans society were well into their cups. Already couples were disappearing into the hedgerow deep within the impressive labyrinth, seeking shadowy corners, awash in fervent whispers. Celine fiddled with the low-cut edge of her emerald gown, trying, in vain, to tug it higher.
"Stop fretting over it, mon ami. You'll only draw more attention to the
impressive swath of bare skin there," Odette said from beside Celine, her long sheath dress falling from her shoulders in a cascade of lavender organza, her hair cocooned in a shimmering net atop her head. She had styled herself in Regency garb, with a hint of Greco-Roman influence. A skein of whisper-thin tulle stained a deep Tyrian purple had been draped across her chest, its ends left a trail down her back. Around her waist was a golden girdle, inspired by the character Hippolyta, Queen of the Amazons.
"I don't mind a swath of bare skin," Celine retorted. "I do mind my bare breasts spilling over the top of my dress at a party replete with satyrs."
Odette laughed, her ivory fan fluttering her loose brunette curls.
"If that happens, you'll have 10 marriage proposals by the end of the evening."
"I have no intention of becoming the future Madame Goat," Celine sniffed.
"Besides that, I feel like a ham trussed up for holiday dinner."
Odette's laughter rang into the starlit sky.
"One glass of champagne and you're far more entertaining than the bard himself."
The edges of her lovely face crinkled as she gazed upon Celine, her expression warm.
"Before I forget, you look divine in that color. It's a perfect match for your eyes."
Her words caused Celine to flinch. Her tormentor that night in the quarter had used that word, divine, meaning of the gods. She certainly didn't feel of the gods tonight.
"I should have gone dressed as a tree," Celine said in a flat tone.
When her gaze ran the length of the hedgerow, she caught a glimpse of yet another satyr, his goat ears high on his curly head, a tail fashioned of wool and feathers pinned to the back of his gabardine trousers. Exasperation rippled through her chest.
"Have any of these fools actually read the play?"
Odette cackled with merriment, her long purple mantle swirling about her feet. A familiar figure caught Celine's attention across the way. Her heart missed a beat when a pair of sapphire eyes skimmed dangerously close to where Celine stood, the smile below them sweet and serene. Pippa Montrose was in attendance at this soiree, dressed as Titania, the Queen of the Fairies, if Celine had to hazard a guess. She'd arrived on the arm of a placid young man with a slender frame and large round spectacles, likely Phoebus Devereaux. Thankfully, it appeared Pippa had yet to spot Celine across the crowded expanse. Without a second thought, Celine turned in place, positioning her back to Pippa, all the while wishing she could shrink into the rose bushes. If Pippa saw her, a confrontation would likely ensue. Pippa had sent 2 messages to the hotel today alone, both inquiring after Celine's welfare. In the latter part of the afternoon, Pippa had come to the domain in person, hoping to check on her friend. Celine had begged off each attempt to make contact, spinning a web of white lies designed to keep Pippa as far away from her as possible, even if it meant damaging their relationship. Better that Pippa feel cast aside than remain in the murderer's notice. "We should leave," Celine muttered to Odette, just as another parcel of jubilant partygoers hoisted a young man onto their shoulders and proceeded to cheer as if his horse had won the derby. Odette drew closer, her features tufting with concern.
"I thought you wanted to meet with Bastian. Is something wrong?"
"Nothing is wrong." Celine struggled to appear nonchalant.
"It's just been 3 hours since we arrived. If he had any intention of showing his face, he would be here by now."
Odette tossed a dismissive hand into the air, the jewels adorning her fingers flashing, definitely not made of paste.
"Oh, fiddle-dee-dee, he's always late to these kinds of things. The fiend enjoys making an entrance."
Despite Odette's reassurances, doubt unfurled in Celine's stomach. Madeline and Hortense had arrived not after Celine and Odette, dressed as ethereal fae, their dark shoulders gleaming with gold dust. Boone had trailed in their shadow a moment later, garbed in white, a literal halo about his head. A sight that had caused Odette's body to shake with laughter. Celine was about to renew her objections when Odette waved her fingers in the air above her head, her smile bright.
"Nigel!"
Odette took hold of Celine's hand to tug her along. Closer to where Pippa and Phoebus stood engaged in conversation with the creme de la creme of the Crescent City.
"Odette,
Celine gasped, trying to extricate herself from Odette's determined grip. The damp warmth of the night and the dull roar of the festivities succeeded in drowning out Celine's protests. Nigel met them halfway, two masked figures sauntering behind him at an unhurried pace. His tall frame wove with ease around the countless bodies milling and spilling about. Like most of the other guests in attendance, he had taken a rather blasé approach to his costume, resorting to winding a few willow branches around his arms, their leaves drooping, the overall effect lackluster save for the laurel crown gracing his brow. Boone appeared out of nowhere, startling Celine as he sidled next to her, his loose white shirt billowing about his trim torso, the halo of gold across his forehead tilted askew. Grateful for the cover his closeness provided, Celine paused to peruse his attire. "And who are you supposed to be?"
"Theseus," Boone said without hesitation.
"The founder hero of Athens?" Disbelief flared across Celine's face. "Be serious, you're dressed as an angel." Boone shrugged.
"Honestly, I thought this was a fate for saints and sinners."
"And you thought to go dressed as a saint?"
"Didn't you know, darling?"
he drawled.
"Oh, the best saints are sinners."
Despite everything, Celine laughed, the sound filling her lungs, causing her tight-laced stays to stretch farther. She pressed a hand to her sternum, exhaling slowly to catch her breath. With the hunger of a seasoned sinner, Boone ogled Celine's chest, the irony not at all lost on her. Nigel grinned as Odette shoved Boone in the shoulder, a note of warning in her eyes. The next instant, she turned to Nigel and sighed a soul-deep sigh.
"Just whom are you hoping to channel in that godforsaken costume? I expected better of you, Lord Fitzroy."
"Oberon, of course."
Nigel twisted the waxed ends of his ruddy mustache, his expression mischievous, his accent thick.
"One and only king of the fairies."
"King of the overgrown trees, more like,"
Odette teased, as she tore away a lifeless leaf along his elbow. He peered down at her with exaggerated imperiousness.
"Regardless, I lord over everything in my domain. Kneel before me, Hippolyta."
"You lord over nothing, my silly sweet boy."
Odette swiped a gloved fingertip beneath his chin, a ghost of a smile lingering on her face.
"Least of all the Queen of the Amazons."
Nigel bowed deeply, the leaves wrapped around his wrist, trembling from his motions. He sent a cheeky nod to Celine, whose attention strayed toward the two masked figures loitering in his shadow. Perhaps loitering was the wrong word, for neither gentleman appeared to be the least bit concerned with the unfolding spectacle. One of them was obviously Arjun Desai. The mask of a donkey concealed the upper half of his burnished face. A felt tail had been attached to his backside. At least he'd paid the soiree's theme the appropriate due, for he obviously meant to portray Nick Bottom, the poor fool transformed into a beast of burden by the notorious trickster Robin Goodfellow. Arjun scanned his surroundings, his eyes falling on Pippa, his lips twitching.
"Is that your friend on the arm of Phoebus Devereux?"
he asked Celine.
"I believe so,"
she replied in noncommittal fashion, hoping he would not press the matter further.
"Fascinating."
Arjun's grin widened as he cast a meaningful glance toward the tall, broad-shouldered young man to his left. A mask covered the entirety of his face, complete with a set of spiraled horns twisting away from his brow, the profile reminiscent of a bull. His body was swathed in a leather greatcoat, its large black collar turned up, further shrouding his features from view. His only identifier was the gold signet ring on the smallest finger of his left hand, embossed with the seal of La Côte de Lyon. Celine's gaze lingered on the ring, and Bastian's graceful fingers flexed at his sides, as if they could sense her unwavering study. It should have meant nothing for Celine to notice this particular crack in his facade. But, to her endless chagrin, it caused her stomach to tighten and her skin to tingle, as if she had stepped out into a bracing winter's night. His awareness made her feel alive, which meant it fell somewhere between nothing and everything. A bothersome development, to be sure. Almost as troubling as the inevitable question that followed. Was Bastian pleased to see her? Or was he irritated? This was the first time they had seen each other since admitting their mutual attraction, the night they had agreed to be nothing more than mere acquaintances. Alas, the presence of a mere acquaintance would not cause a swarm of butterflies to take flight in Celine's stomach, to cluster around her heart, their wings fluttering. Frustration warmed beneath her skin. Odette struck a dramatic pose, her right hip jutting forward as she gestured toward Bastian.
Pray tell, just who are you supposed to be?
The minutes are.
A rich voice emanated from behind the bull mask, amusement rounding its tone.
Is there a minotaur in Shakespeare's play? Odette queried.
Bastian shook his horned head once. Well, bully for you, Celine joked, wishing she could see his eyes, wishing she could read his thoughts like the pages of a beloved book. Pausing to savor every word. Her fingers moved into her pocket of their own volition, pinching his insolent note, stoking the anger in her blood, hoping the blaze would overcome the desire. The bull's head tilted in Celine's direction, the motion filled with scorn. Then Bastian glanced away, as if he were bored with the very idea of her. Though it was subtle, his dismissal enraged Celine beyond reason, the fire of fury swallowing everything in its path. She crumpled the note in her fist. He had already disregarded her once today, after which Celine had gone to immense trouble to attend this godforsaken gathering, all with the intention of confronting him. And he thought to treat her with derision? Madness. To the very end. It was true, a foolish part of Celine had wanted to see him and be seen in return. She deserved to feel wounded now. Nothing good ever came from succumbing to madness. No matter. To borrow his own words, Celine would grant Bastian no quarter. He'd trifled with her long enough. These weren't the actions of an acquaintance. These were the actions of an enemy. She had had her fill of enemies. If Bastian was the Minotaur, Celine would be Theseus, armed with the sword of Aegeus, ready to slay the beast. As if Arjun could taste the discomfort collecting in the air, he laughed, pushing his donkey mask up his face, the silk ties swiping through his unruly waves. Well, I'd wager this event to be the height of this season's debauchery. Anyone care to name the terms? His British accent sounded too refined for a party in which satyrs roamed the gardens with insidious ease. Too cultured for a night in which drunken fools lost their inhibitions in a maze of fragrant rose bushes, forgetting all their thorns. As if to illustrate the point, a striking young woman with hair the color of smoldering embers poured a glass of bubbling champagne down the pale skin of her throat, letting it dribble between her collarbones and soak through the front of her bodice. It traced the shape of her breasts before she feigned outrage, as if she had simply missed her mouth. Her ensuing giggles high and false. Whatever attention the girl sought to garner, she succeeded. Every eye, male and female alike, was locked on her slender form, equal parts scandalized and tantalized. With a smug smile, she whirled into her circle of tittering friends, safe and cosseted. For now. Distracted by the exhibition, Pippa's shocked gaze landed on Celine, the same realization stealing through them in the next breath. A flash of pain shimmered across Pippa's features, her lips parting in surprise. The next instant, she leaned toward her escort, speaking with him in hushed tones. Celine knew it would take less than 10 paces for Pippa to face her. Less than half that for the murderer to notice were he present, as she suspected. And Celine simply could not allow that to happen. Panic took root in her stomach. Maddening laughter lilted into the air around them, mingling with incessant chatter. The scent of fresh herbs and the iron of overturned soil filled her nostrils as Celine looked about, seeking an escape. In a single sinuous motion, Bastien removed his bull mask, his silver eyes like storm clouds. His expression guarded, as if he could sense her distress. They locked gazes for a blink of time. The next instant, Celine wheeled about without warning, rushing toward the entrance of the maze, her cream-colored hem snagging on thorns as she ran. Darkness incarnate. Celine didn't know why she was sure Bastien would follow her. She just knew, with the certainty of a rising moon, that he would. When she glanced over her shoulder, the shape of his greatcoat stretched behind her, and a jolt of something unseen, unheard, unfelt, before this moment, raced through her blood. It pulsed in time with her heart, sending her rushing down a wicked path, deeper into wicked darkness. She was Theseus, setting a trap for the mighty Minotaur in a cursed labyrinth. As if she led him on a string, Bastien glided in her footsteps. Celine felt him through the layers of shadow, like the night had embraced her, remaking her in its own image. The sounds of merriment faded into sighs, the smell of sweat and trampled flowers steeping in the warm air. Celine wove past a pair of young women embracing in a corner, rose petals crushed to paste beneath their feet. A shoulder strap on one girl's gown had slid down her arm, the rouge on her lover's lips nothing more than a smudge across her cheek. Her face flaming with apology, Celine rounded the next corner and came upon a dead end. She spun in place, her head held high. Bastien stood before her, backlit by the moon, his upturned collar concealing most of his face, the head of the Minotaur dangling from one hand. She glared at him through the void, vowing to hold fast to her plan, though the space around them thickened with suggestion. "The Minotaur, Bastien? Really?"
"I possess a certain affinity for monsters."
"And a long black coat?"
"I enjoy making a spectacle."
His face held nothing but shadows, the set of his jaw refined, as if nothing about the situation troubled him in the slightest. It provoked Celine further. "And what of Annabelle's yellow ribbon?" Bastien took a step closer. An arctic chill emanated from his skin.
"What of it?"
"Why do you have it?" He said nothing for a time.
"Why do you think I have it?"
Bastien took another step closer, pressing Celine into the corner. "Stop," she commanded. He halted in his tracks.
"Are you afraid?"
"No. I'm furious."
"I see."
Bastien's response was slow, deliberate.
"You think I killed her?"
he said quietly. The cold of night made it difficult for Celine to discern his features.
"I don't know what to think anymore. If I told you I didn't kill her, would you believe me? If I said I found the ribbon on the stairwell, would that ring true?"
He advanced once more, prowling like a panther, the timbre of his voice lowering even further.
Or would you believe me if I told you it belonged to someone I loved long ago?
I don't know.
Do you want to believe me?
It was as if Lucifer himself had posed Selene the question, his tone filled with dark deviltry. Yes, her heart said.
No.
Selene's hands balled into fists.
Liar.
The last step Bastion took brought his face into a beam of moonlight. A sharp breath filled Selene's lungs. He was painfully beautiful. Not in the way of art or the way of poetry, but in the way of violence. The way the sight of it gripped you and took hold. Like a lightning storm behind a bank of clouds, a tidal wave crashing upon a shore. A reminder that life was a moment in time.